Welcome to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. This is my first official show as host, although I've been filling in for Larry Mueller for about 10 years now, and I am more than honored to carry on his legacy of learning and love of gardening. I think I earned a graduate degree from working with him, and I am forever grateful. And I am also grateful to have Brian Huddleston on with me today, Dr. Death to his friends, of course. Brian is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, and he has news of the latest diseases for you to look out for. Do you need help diagnosing those diseases? Well, give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Brian, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hi, Jill. Congratulations on your first show. This is really wonderful.
Thank you so much, Brian. I really appreciate you being with me today. We were hoping Lisa could be with us too, but she had something else she had to do, and she'll be with us a little bit later in the month. But you guys are a dynamic duo. You're fine.
We've known each other for years.
Yes,
so
you have.
We went to high school together. So, yeah. Love doing the show with her, but
yeah, but you're just fine on your own too. We certainly have enough to talk about, especially in the middle of summer. So
yeah, and based on the number of samples I had in the clinic this morning when I was in, diseases are out there and going rampant.
Yeah, what the heck is with that? I mean, I didn't think. I mean, it's kind of hot. We had some rain. It's not been super dry. Yeah. Why are we having such a bumper year?
Yeah, I think we had early rains, which were very important, particularly for a lot of the tree leaf diseases I've been seeing.
Okay.
Those oftentimes get established very early. And if we tend to have rains around the time when the trees are leafing out, then later in the season, I'll start to see an increase in those sorts of samples coming into the lab.
Okay.
So,
all right.
But
well,
also I'm seeing vascular wilts too. I was testing for oak wilt today. Pretty sure I had a positive there. Testing for Dutch elm disease, I'm sure I had a positive, and I had another sample I'm pretty sure is positive for verticillium wilt. So everything's out there having a happy time.
Yeah, that's too bad, because I mean, some of the things I know in my garden are looking amazing, but I also have some things that are looking a little scary, which I need to talk to you about myself. We've got a whole bunch of calls, so I have a feeling everybody else is feeling the same way. But before we get to them, I just wanted to let's start at the number one disease of all time, which I just, wow, what an honor. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah. A disease I see every year, and I've seen it. I've been in the clinic almost 30 years now, and the disease I see most commonly is on spruce trees. It's called Rhizosphera needle cast. If you've ever seen particularly a blue spruce with very bare lower branches, but maybe a few little green needles at the tips of those branches, you've seen Rhizosphera needle cast. The fungus gets in there, infects the newer needles, but just kind of sits around and then kind of becomes active as those needles end up farther towards the interior of the canopy, and then will cause the needles to drop prematurely. So it causes a lot of unaesthetic problems in spruce trees, makes them look rather ugly over time, unfortunately.
Yes, unfortunately, the fence line near my cabin is mostly spruce trees in there.
Yeah.
I've been spending a lot of money removing those nasty looking trees. So,
yeah.
There's nothing you can do, right?
No, I just tell folks it's not a lethal disease, but it makes the tree so ugly you wish they were dead. So and so most people tend to remove them like you're doing right now. So my major thing is don't plant blue spruce. It's an overused tree. It's not well adapted to our weather here in Wisconsin.
These aren't blue spruce. They're regular old, you know, I don't know what kind of
white
spruce.
Maybe,
I think they
Black
are.
Black Hills.
Yeah, I think they're white.
That's
spruce.
Another species of spruce that's quite susceptible to this disease.
Yep. Oh, well, I should know better. Actually, my dad planted those, so I'll blame him. Okay. Let's go to Brian in Madison. Go right ahead, Brian.
Hi. I am calling because I have what I think is a fungus. I've got some grape that I planted maybe 15, 20 years ago in my backyard. It's probably Frontenac, mixed also maybe with Marquette. And about 5-6 days ago, I started seeing what I see every year is they just start shriveling up and just kind of dying off. I've never treated it. I'm an organic gardener, and I really hesitate to treat my things with pesticides, but I'm looking for some advice.
Yeah, if you're seeing really kind of shriveling grapes like that, it's probably a disease called black rot. That's a common fungal disease that we see on grapes. The other place where you'll see symptoms will be on the leaves. If you're seeing relatively small, I would say maybe about half an inch diameter, kind of circular spots on the leaves, that's a leaf phase of the same disease. We also see this disease on Boston ivy. It causes a leaf spot on that particular vine as well. But it gets into the fruits and it causes them to mummify. And if you look very carefully at those fruits, if once they're shrunken down, if it looks like they have a whole series of little bumps on the fruits, that's an indication of this disease. Those are the reproductive structures of the fungus. Typically, what we recommend is good cleanup of the leaves for that. And then that's where and also the fruits, any of those shriveled fruits. So good cleanup at the end of the growing season. Make sure you get rid of all of that material. If you have things like Virginia creeper, anywhere around that, that's also a host for this pathogen. So getting rid of that can be a good thing to reduce the level of spores that are around. And then if you're not really interested in treating, if you want to try to do it organically, some of the copper sprays that are labeled for use on grapes would be useful. The traditional granddaddy of the fungicides, Bordeaux mix, would provide some help with combating this particular disease. That's a combination of copper sulfate and lime. So good fall cleanup. If you really don't want to spray at all, then good fall cleanup. Good pruning practices to have an open canopy to get good airflow and to help dry things out in the canopy will be beneficial as well.
Okay, thanks for the question, Brian. And Brian, good airflow is key to a lot of
diseases.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
So a lot of plant pathogens are fungal, so they like either wet leaves, which is virtually all of the foliar fungal pathogens, or in the terms of others like powdery mildews, they prefer dry leaves but really high humidity. We've got great weather for powdery mildew right now.
Oh yeah,
because it's our muggy July weather.
Speaking powdery of which, Carolyn Madison, please go right ahead.
Hi, I have a 9-bar squash which started with powdery mildew earlier in the year. I sprayed it. I've cut back as much as I can, but the whole bush is deteriorating and it's even branches are kind of breaking inside it. And I've heard that you can cut them back to a low level and then have them rejuvenate possibly, but I don't know when to do it, if that is the best. I've cut out as much of the old cane as I can right now, and it's not looking good. It's really looking bad.
Yeah. There may be something else going on in that shrub other than just the powdery mildew. Is it a green foliaged or a red foliaged variety cultivar of 9-bar?
It turns red in the, it's starting, what's left of it's starting to turn red right now. It turns red.
But it's green normally when it comes out in the spring?
It comes out green and then over the course of the summer, the foliage becomes redder.
Redder. Okay. Yeah. Cause where I normally see really powdery mildew on 9-bark is on the red foliaged cultivars. So the worst of the 9-barks is Diablo in my mind. It gets such severe powdery mildew that you do see a lot of branch dieback. Now in the more green foliaged ones, usually it's more of a cosmetic issue. So I wonder if you're dealing with some of
Oops.
Other than just the powdery mildew. Certainly, I would expect to see some powdery mildew on it. So there may be something else going on. So this might be a situation where you might want to consider sending in a sample to my clinic so that we can take a look at it. Or send me some digital photos if you have the ability to do that. I'll give out my email address if that's okay with you, Jill.
Yep,
and,
absolutely.
You can email me those photos. Yeah, my email is P as in Paul, D as in David, D as in David again, C as in Charles, at WISC.edu. And again, because you're seeing so much dieback on it, and it's more of a sort of a green foliage variety where I don't typically see super severe problems with powdery mildew. Again, I'm wondering if there may be another leaf disease or some other disease that's at play here. And knowing if that's the case is important in terms of making appropriate control recommendations.
All right. Thank you very much for that question, Carol. And let's then go to Angela in Madison. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm hoping you can solve my problem. I have four sweet bush shrubs in my front yard in Madison, and they're doing phenomenally well, except one in May developed a branch that had drooping, you know, the leaves are huge, had drooping, almost looked like they were withering on the branch itself, and it seemed to be spreading, so I cut them off and was prematurely excited because it looked great, and now the same thing is happening again, and it's just always one large branch, and then the others are fine, so I'm not sure what is going on.
Yeah, based on the pattern of dieback that you're describing, I'm kind of suspicious of a disease called verticillium wilt. It's another fungal disease. This fungus hangs out in the soil and infects through the roots, colonizes the water-conducting tissue inside the plant, and blocks it off. And so that prevents water from getting from the root system up into the branches. And oftentimes you get what we call a sectional dieback of a tree or shrub that has this fungus, where it'll be like you've described. It's a single branch, and you'll maybe cut that off, and then it'll be another branch or maybe a small cluster of branches, but eventually it'll move its way through the shrub. And it is a lethal disease. It will kill the shrub eventually if that's what you're dealing with. To confirm again, it would require testing. We actually try to grow the fungus out of branches that we think have this particular disease. If you're interested, I gave out my email address. Feel free to contact me. Unfortunately, in terms of management, it's replacing the shrub. And so remove the one that's there that's infected, get rid of it because you're not going to be able to save it, and then select something that typically does not get infected by this particular fungus. And the best option, quite frankly, would be a conifer of some kind. For some reason, conifers don't seem to get infected by verticillium. There are some broadleaf trees and shrubs that you could look into. One that I sometimes recommend is amelanchier or serviceberry. And that one technically can be infected by the fungus, but I've never seen it be a serious problem on that particular shrub. And it's a night, you can get several different sizes of that particular plant, some tree forms, some shrub forms, and they flower in the spring and make fruit that the birds really love. So, and there are other options as well. If you're interested, if you go to my clinic website, just do a search on Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, UW-Madison. We have a fact sheet on verticillium wilt that has a more extended list of resistant or immune plants that you can put in.
Oh, Angela, I hope that's not the case, but better to know sooner than later. Yeah, for sure. Thanks for the call. We have a couple open lines, so give us a call, 800-642-1234. Of course, you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. John emailed us. He has a question about his roses, a fungus that he has never seen before attacked the flower buds on 5 of his roses, and it left the rest alone. It's been a month, but no new buds have appeared. Have you ever seen that before?
What I see, particularly if the buds kind of formed but never opened, they kind of rotted in place before they opened up. It could be a disease called gray mold or botrytis blight. Botrytis is the name of the fungus that's involved. It's a somewhat wimpy pathogen in a way, but it does tend to infect flowers on a wide range of plants. I see this on peonies sometimes as well, causing the forming buds to abort and kind of dry up. And that could very well be what you're dealing with. Again, I just usually don't see a lot of it. So I tell folks, if you see a particular bud that's doing that, just clip it off. There are some fungicide treatments that you can potentially use for control, but in my mind, it's not as that common a problem for most home gardeners. It can be a big problem in commercial flower production, though. But for home gardeners, it's usually not a big enough issue where I typically recommend fungicide treatments. Again, if you want to read up more on this disease, go to my clinic website into the fact sheet section and look up gray mold, and you'll find a fact sheet on it. And actually, the picture I have on there is of roses with it attacking the rosebuds.
Ah, okay. Wonderful reference. Rob in Verona called, but he couldn't stay with us. What can you do for peonies that have a fungal botrytis infection?
Yeah, that's the one we were just talking about, actually.
Okay.
So same fungus. And again, usually it ends up in the flowers. And although you can get a later season version of that disease on the leaves, with that, I typically tell folks to kind of ignore that because it occurs so late in the growing season, typically, that it doesn't have a big impact on the plants. But the main thing in the winter, in the fall, or after the plants have gone dormant for the winter, is to remove as much of that old plant debris as possible and get rid of it. You can burn it if you have that option where you live. You can bury it. You can, if you're a good hot composter, you can compost that material and get rid of it. But botrytis is pretty common in the environment. So even if you get rid of all of your infected material from your peonies or from your roses, then you can still have problems with the fungus because it's pretty common in the environment. The spores will blow around for a long distance. Again, there are fungicide treatments, but unless you have a kind of a chronic problem where you're seeing it year after year after year, I don't normally recommend fungicide treatments.
Okay.
So
let's go back to the phone. Scott in Windsor, go right ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I have a friend whose tomato plant just suffered massive wilt recently, and it's happened every year. It doesn't look fungal to me. I attribute it to the presence of a 50-foot walnut tree growing about 40 yeah. feet from raised bed. Is there any site remediation that's possible, or does he have to just move his beds?
Oh, I hear you, Scott.
Better to move the beds. Yeah.
Yeah.
Better to move the bed if you possibly can. The other thing you can try to do if you don't have any other options would be to create raised beds for plants like tomatoes, which are particularly sensitive to walnuts. What walnuts do is they produce these compounds called juglones, which tend to kill off other plants, kind of an anti-competition sort of thing that goes on with walnut trees. And pretty much every part of the plant will produce these compounds. So the roots will exude the...
Oh, we just lost. We're having a little bit of... Okay, you popped off a little bit there, Brian. So
okay.
After roots...
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Yeah, the compounds are in the leaves and the fruits as well. So you have to be careful of any part of the plant. So the best thing to do, again, in this situation would be to find another area that's as far away from that walnut tree as possible. Keep in mind, though, that the roots of a tree can spread out from the trunk about 3 to 5 times the height of the tree. So even if you're far away from that walnut, you still might encounter a stray root that could cause some problems. So raised beds, again, is another option. Growing the plants in large pots is another way of getting around walnut issues as well. And please do not incorporate any of the leaves into your garden. Bad news. I had a client who called me years ago and had done that, and that's not a good thing at all.
Yep. I've been there, like I said, Scott. And also, the squirrels like to bury those nuts in
yes.
your garden, and I had that problem too. So I moved.
Yep.
And the squirrels,
that seems a little extreme, Jill, unless there were other reasons why he wanted to move.
There were other reasons, but...
Okay.
And then I found out there was a black walnut
bonus.
Tree 3 houses down, and the squirrels found me
yeah.
again. It's not as bad, though. I'm doing pretty good. But, oh, my yeah. goodness. Yeah, they're horrible. They're horrible. So good luck to your neighbor.
I've, Yeah, I've killed off plants in my own yard from not dealing with volunteer walnut trees. I have a talk that I give called Confessions of a Black Thumb, plants that I have killed or at least thoroughly maimed. And that's one of the case studies where I let a little walnut tree that a squirrel planted the nut grow, and it grew one of the roots through the root mass of another of my ornamentals and killed it off. So,
Yep.
Personal experience.
Yep. And you keep cutting them back and cutting them back, and then you just have this huge gnarly mess that ends up because they're
shrub.
Yep. They're determined. They're determined for sure. So, Kathy and Greenleaf, you are next. Go right ahead.
Okay. My question is with my, I have a Colorado blue spruce, a foxtail. So it's a special tree. It looks absolutely beautiful. There are no spots on the needles, except it is dying one branch at a time from the top down. And at first I thought it was due to the fact that it did have like a double leader. And I thought, well, 1 liter, something happened and that's dying. But it took care of all the branches on that leader, and now it's working on the other one. But it's one branch at a time, top down, and no spots on any of the needles of the rest of the tree.
Yeah, I'm wondering if this may be an insect problem rather than a disease problem. There certainly are diseases that can cause branch dieback like that. They are usually fungal diseases. They're what are called canker diseases. So the fungus infects a branch and then girdles it, and then that prevents water movement into the branch and the branch dies off. So there is a possibility that you could have an infection maybe in the main trunk up towards the top of the tree, and that fungus is girdling the trunk and then kind of moving its way down the trunk. That's a possibility. The way you deal with that, though, is to basically kind of find that interface between live and dead branches and come down about 4 to 6 inches below that, and then cut off the top of the tree. That's not a thing that I like to recommend that people do, because that really changes the aesthetics of the tree. But if you have an infection like this, that's about the only real management strategy for it, is to cut it out. If you're going to do that and need to make other pruning cuts on the tree, make sure you decontaminate your tools between cuts. Use something like 70% alcohol, rubbing alcohol, would be something that's commonly available to most people. You can buy it at the drugstore. Just kind of drench the tools and allow them to sit treated with the alcohol for about 30 seconds before you make another cut. Again, I'm wondering a little bit, you know, about insects, because there are some boring insects that can sometimes affect kind of the tops of trees. But that would be a question to pose to my counterpart in the entomology department, PJ Leash. He's our insect diagnostician. If you could take some photos of the tree again and email those to me, I can pass those on to PJ and see if he thinks it might be an insect problem. Again, I think probably the management strategy is going to be to prune that area of the tree out, though.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. And I think we probably have somebody coming on soon talking about insects, too. So that's okay. Something to watch for also, Kathy. I'm not sure who or when. But I was trying to bring up the calendar, but I wasn't fast enough. So anyway, but thank you for that call, Kathy. We appreciate that. Those darn blue spruce. Oh, my gosh, Brian.
Yeah, not a tree I recommend, because they do get a lot of canker diseases. But the pattern is weird in this particular situation, that it's starting at the top. And most of the time, again, because I deal with fungi, it's wetter at the bottom of the tree. So typically we see canker diseases start there.
Okay, absolutely. Well, we are talking about diseases with our wonderful guest, Dr. Brian Huddleston. He's the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. And we have another half hour with him. And then coming up after the top of the hour, we are going to be talking about choosing evergreen trees for a live fence for privacy. So make sure you stick around with that, and we'll be back after a little break. Stay with us. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Najeau. We're talking about plant disease with Brian Huddleston. Today, if you've got a question for him, we have got open lines. I can't believe it. 800-642-1234. So give us a call. The email, if you want to give us an email, that's talk@wpr.org. You can send us a picture. Oh, it looks like Brian's having trouble seeing some pictures. Oh, my pictures, probably because they're too big, Brian. Sorry about that. I'm having a little problem with my butterfly weed, and I'm just about ready to cry because it was so beautiful last year. But I have a feeling that the picture that was sent from Monica in Milwaukee is kind of similar, because the leaves, if you see that one, she has at least 20 established plants that are nearly all turning yellow and showing spots, and they're dropping lower leaves, and some are developing disfigured leaves and buds. And she said that some of the leaves have a white, gritty material underneath. And she said she generally gets powdery mildew, but that's later in the season. But this is earlier and worse than what she's had in the past. And she sent this picture, and you can see the leaves are turning yellow, kind of got the green vein still. But, mine are similar to that. So what's going on with that?
And this is on phlox. Is that what those photos were?
It looks like hers are phlox. Mine, like I said, are butterfly weed.
Yeah, butterfly weed. On phlox, I'd really worry about mite issues. They are very common on phlox and will cause a lot of yellowing of the leaves.
Okay.
And that might explain kind of the gritty white on the bottom surface of the leaf, because there could be a lot of shed skins from the mites that might give it a kind of a whitish, gritty sort of look.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and then in terms of what has your butterfly weed, has it flowered?
Yes, it's flowering.
And it looks normal?
It looked normal until like just maybe yesterday, and all of a sudden it's got a few brown spots on it as well as the yellowing leaves, and the flowers themselves are starting to, it almost looks like it's drying up, but I've been definitely watering it, so I don't know what's going on. I'm very upset because last year was just so beautiful.
Sometimes what will happen with, I've seen on butterfly bushes, if they get too wet, they are prone to root and crown rots.
Ooh.
And that would cause them to wilt, and that could also lead to yellowing because that'll interfere with nutrient uptake. So that's a possibility. The other thing, the reason I ask about flowers is that there's also a group of pathogens called the phytoplasmas that are moved around by leaf hoppers, and they get injected into the food conducting tissue inside the plant, and they can cause yellowing as well. The most common disease that's a phytoplasma disease is aster yellows. So the plants in that milkweed group are susceptible to phytoplasma diseases, whether it's actually aster yellows or slightly different organism, I'm not quite sure about, but I have seen phytoplasmas in milkweed. So that's a possibility, but usually if it's a phytoplasma, you see weird looking flowers as well. They often are leafy and green and just don't look right. But if you've got normal looking flowers, then I would check the root health of the plant if you can. And that could lead to browning on the leaves too.
Okay.
So that's my first thought.
All right.
For that.
So what should I do?
It may be a situation where it's time to buy a new milkweed and plant it in a new area away from where this one was located.
Oh, fine.
And keep it more on the dry side, because that does a little bit better in slightly drier conditions.
Okay. Yeah. You know, I think we ruin most of our plants by giving them too much water. So
not me. I starve mine for water.
Well, you are
I'm notorious for killing plants by drought stress.
Okay. Well, speaking of, let's just look at some of the other diseases that you have on your list now. I see that the septoria leaf spot on lilac is starting. You're starting to see that a little bit more now.
Yeah. I had a sample of that yesterday, actually.
Mm-hmm. Describe that so people know what we're talking about.
Yeah. You'll see a lot of people have probably encountered septoria leaf spot on tomatoes, where you get the browning of the leaves at the bottom of the plant. It kind of works its way up the tomato plant. Septoria on lilac is very, very similar. It's a slightly different Septoria fungus, different species, but it works in the same way. It tends to start towards the bottom of the plant on the leaves. You'll get a lot of brown spotting, and then eventually the browning will get so bad that the leaves will entirely dry up. and then it'll kind of make its way up the shrub. So you'll have a shrub that has green leaves at the top, but the bottom of the shrub will be primarily brown. And that's another fungal disease, and it's managed primarily by making sure that you do good winter cleanup. Whether you do it in the fall or wait until the spring, you want to get rid of that old plant leaf tissue that's dropped off the shrubs and get rid of that. So burn, bury, or hot compost. And then there, again, are fungicide treatments, but I usually try to tell folks to, you know, work with getting rid of leaf debris. And then also, again, pruning and thinning of lilac shrubs will help manage that as well, because again, it'll dry things out. And as an added bonus, when with the shrub lilacs, when you prune out those older canes, the larger diameter canes, and thin the shrubs, you tend to get a flush of new growth and you get better blooming as well. So they blossom better.
Okay. Well, we've got a couple of calls here. Bruce in Black Earth, go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have a problem with our broccoli plants. We started them indoors, and we always grow about 8 a year. And this year, 2 of them have suddenly died. And we've never had that problem before. And my son's got the same problem with his broccoli, and he's never had it before. Could you give us any idea what is wrong?
Yeah. Did you see any symptoms on the leaves, like yellowing or browning, kind of wedge-shaped brown areas, maybe with yellow margins? Did you see any of that by any chance?
No, they just wilted.
Just wilted. It could be this flame wilt that I talked about, although I don't see that real commonly on broccoli, but I believe though that is potentially a host for it. Other things that could be would be, I hope you don't have white mold. That's another fungal disease. What I would check on those plants that have wilted over time would be if you start to see little black structures, they might form on the surface of the plant, or if you cut open the stem, they might form inside the stem. But if you see these little black structures, they look like little mouse or rat droppings, then that's an indication of this disease called white mold. And that's a fungal disease. It's not the one that you really want, because those little black structures will survive in the soil for an extended period of time. If you see those, dig up the plant as quickly as you can, kind of remove the soil around the plant and get that out of your garden. Sometimes if you catch the disease quickly enough, you can remove it before those little resting structures get distributed in the soil. There's also a possibility of just kind of general root rot issues on the plants. That's another possibility. Again, without seeing an actual plant, I can't be more specific than that, but definitely, hopefully not verticillium, because that goes to a wide range of vegetable crops, including your tomatoes and peppers and eggplants, potatoes, vine crops. That's really a disaster. White mold has a very wide host range as well. So again, that could be another one that could be very, very problematic. The reason I ask about the kind of browning on the leaves with the yellow margins is there is another group of our disease. It kind of affects the brassicas or the cold crops in general, called black rot, which is a bacterial disease. But again, the typical symptoms with that will be some kind of browning, oftentimes starting around the margins of the leaves and then working its way back along the veins. You'll see kind of a yellow halo, and that can take out plants as well. There might also be some insect activity in these plants too, because there could be some insect borers that are coming and boring into the plants and causing collapse of the plants because of their activity. So a lot of possibilities here.
Ooh, well, you're just a ray of sunshine, Brian.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm Dr. Death. Again, if you want to try to figure out what this is, my suggestion would be to submit a sample to my clinic. Again, if you email me, I can provide details on how to do that. And with the broccoli example, I'd be inclined to send it to PJ Leash, our insect diagnostician, first, because I have to charge for my service, but his service is free. So definitely if it's an insect, you want to send it his way first.
Yeah, good luck, Bruce. But like Brian said, get to that sooner than later so you can maybe
do some preventative there. And just as an FYI, we have Phil Pelletieri actually is going to be with us, or with Lee, on Wednesday to talk about insects. So if you want to talk to someone online or on the air, that's who will be with us next Wednesday, 11 to 12 on the Lee Rayburn Show. So Phil will be in. He's still popping in every once in a while, even though he's been retired for 15 years
quite a while now.
Yeah.
Great guy, though.
He is.
He was there when I started in the clinic, so we worked together for a long, long time.
Yep, he is PJ's predecessor, and he's still keeping up on everything, so excellent. Let's go now to Dave in Madison. He has a question for you. Go ahead, Dave.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I hope I don't have too many questions here, but I got three. I've got a problem with iris borer in one of four beds of iris that I have. Now, it's gone pretty far, and I'll have to take that out, and I probably won't be able to save much of it. But how do I prevent that from happening again, first in the place it happened, but also in the other beds that don't seem to have it yet?
Yeah, again, that's unfortunately an insect question, so that's a little bit outside of my realm of expertise, but my suggestion would be to email PJ Leash about that. His email is PLIESCH@WISC.edu. And also, if you do a search online for the UW Extension Horticulture website, there should be a fact sheet on iris borer on that website as well. That I think was written by Phil Pelletieri, actually, years ago.
Yeah, not much has changed on that nasty little guy.
No.
So,
If I could, two quick questions. I have flock. I mentioned that you mentioned a shortly ago that mites can be a problem. What would be the best way to prevent a problem there?
Again, a question for PJ, because that's in his realm his realm of expertise. I know enough about insects to be dangerous, so that's why I don't want to lead you astray.
If it crawls, it's not Brian's.
Let me try one more time, and then I'll try to be brief. I'm noticing spikewort coming in and just sort of coming up and showing up all over the place, and I like it. It's very beautiful, and I would call it either invasive or vigorous, depending on how you want to characterize it. Can it cause any problems? Are there plants that it will injure by showing up?
Spiderwort.
You said spiderwort?
Spiderwort.
Yeah, I love spiderwort. Yeah, it's a native plant. And if you have it, I would say, as long as it's not encroaching on other plants that you like, keep it around. It's a very, 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 very interesting plant. And I think it adds a lot of aesthetic appeal to a landscape. So I would say encourage that. Unless, like you said, it's getting overly aggressive and moving into other areas, then I would pull it out. But no, it's a great plant as far as I'm concerned personally.
Yeah. And if you want my opinion, because it's invading my flower beds, just be careful where you put it. It's one of those things. It's know what you're planting, because it will. It's taken over one of my beds, and I've been pulling and pulling for the last 5 years. It just keeps coming back. But I think if you cut it, it falls over, and that's why I hate it so much, because it looks like someone's trampled it. But I've heard that if you cut it, it'll grow back again and look better. But I don't know if that's true, so you can experiment. But anyway, thanks for all those questions, Dave. We kind of answered those for you, but that's one thing. Our experts are usually experts in one area, and that's how they feel comfortable answering those one areas. But anyway. If anybody else has a disease question, please give us a call. We have some open lines, 800-642-1234. And we do have some more emails here. So next one I'm going to go to is Kay in Rochester. And she noticed this week that the upper leaves of her otherwise healthy pole beans were distorted and wrinkled, and she sent us a photo. She's wondering if there's any idea what might be causing this. Will it kill the plant? Is there anything that they can do? And they are definitely nasty looking. It looks like someone took like plastic in the heat. It's all bubbly.
Two possibilities. The first one would be herbicide exposure, based on what I'm seeing in the photo. And I've had a lot of cases of that within the past roughly 3 weeks, where leaves are coming in that look kind of like the ones of these pole beans. And so if there was any sort of herbicide application, it could be a lawn treatment. It could be, if you're in a rural area, application to an agricultural field. Usually the herbicides, at least one of the herbicides that's applied in these sorts of settings, is what's called a growth regulator herbicide. So they mimic plant growth hormones. And when plants are exposed to those, they get really weird growth. And that's kind of what I'm seeing. The other possibility, although I think less likely, is probably or possibly a viral infection of some kind. And if that's the case, viruses are basically forever in plants. Once they're infected, you can't get rid of them. So you're left with getting rid of the plants, unfortunately. But again, I think in this case, my first thought would be an herbicide exposure. And unfortunately, once vegetable plants are exposed, I consider them adulterated. And so my recommendation is not to eat any of the vegetables that are produced on those plants. So that's kind of it for the pole beans for the season. The real good indicator plant for herbicide exposures is, quite frankly, tomato. They are very sensitive to very low dosages. So if you happen to have tomatoes in your garden, check for symptoms on tomatoes, because they will definitely show them if herbicides are drifting around.
Okay, thank you for the picture, Kay. We got another picture from Jane in Wausau. It was taken a little over a week ago. Her four cucumber plants don't look well at all. Since then, three of them have started to grow taller and look a bit healthier, and some of them have blossoms. Any idea what the issue was to start with?
No, and unfortunately, I can't increase the size on that to get a good look at the detail in the plants. It looks like it's primarily browning on the older leaves, from what I can tell.
Yeah.
And that makes me wonder if there was some sort of, well, it could be possibly, it could be heat stress. That's a possibility. If it was super hot around the time, you know, before that new foliage came out, that's certainly an issue that we've seen some of. If there were any chemical sprays that were made in the vicinity of the plants, could be a chemical burn of some kind, and that could be herbicides, it could be even fertilizer. If it was a spray fertilizer application, that can sometimes burn foliage. The good point, though, is that the plants are growing out of it, so that probably indicates that it's less likely to be a disease problem than something environmental.
Right.
So I would just kind of let the plants grow. I would, though, investigate whether or not there might have been any, again, herbicide contamination. Because, again, if that's a possibility, then I would tend to avoid using the fruits off of those cucumber plants.
Okay, great. Bill emailed us. He said that the lady who called in about the blue spruce with the top-down dieback sounds like it has spruce budworm. If the tips of the branches are curling into a shepherd's crook, that would be another symptom. So thanks for that.
Yep, that's why I work very closely with PJ and worked with Phil years ago, because we trade samples all the time, and things that sometimes we think are diseases are really insect problems, and sometimes things that we think are insect problems turn out to be diseases. So it's very, very difficult sometimes to distinguish exactly what's going on in a plant without seeing a physical sample.
Sure. And sometimes they probably have both, right? The lucky few.
That's right. And often, definitely, most of what I see has multiple diseases, and there are insects there, and there are mites, and there can be a variety of things at one time.
Well, let's talk about apple scab. You said that there's an interesting story involving that.
Yeah, that's interesting. We have a kind of a new foliar disease that's popped up in the state. I saw it for the first time, I think it was 2 years ago, called Marcinina leaf blotch. And it looks very similar in my mind to apple scab. And I was talking with Leslie Holland, who's our fruit pathologist, about this. And what we think may have gone on is for years and years and years, because apple scab has been such an important disease, particularly in commercial apple production, causes problems on crab apples as well. We've really been pushing for people to grow varieties or cultivars of apples and crab apples that are naturally resistant to apple scab, instead of using fungicide treatments, which has been a very traditional means of managing apple scab, particularly in fruit production. And so people have been following our advice, and probably because of that, they've been cutting back on fungicide treatments. And now there's this other fungal pathogen that probably was being controlled by those fungicides that were being used that's now come to the forefront as another problem. So we do our best to make recommendations, but nature has a way of making us kind of look foolish sometimes. So, this new disease, well, it isn't really a new disease. It's been around, but it's becoming more prevalent, again, probably because of what we've been recommending as management for apple scab.
Sure. It's one of those things where it's a kind of catch-22, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's kind of like sometimes we bring in biological control organisms to control diseases or insects, and then they have unforeseen consequences once they're released into the environment.
Yep. You just never know what's going to happen. So you have to be very, very careful. So let's talk a little bit about, are we still worried about winter burn on evergreens? Are we still having lasting effects?
I'm still seeing it come in samples that, where it looks like winter burn. This is a browning of typically the needles on conifers, mm-hmm. or a browning of broadleaf evergreens like boxwood. And I continue to see samples come in that's probably a holdover from this sort of dehydration that occurs over the wintertime. That's basically what winter burn is. The plants don't have enough internally stored water, so the needles or the leaves will brown either over the winter or oftentimes as they come out of dormancy in the spring. And so right now, the sort of detective work you have to do in this sort of situation really revolves around arborvitaes, because I'm getting a lot of arborvitae samples that are coming in with brown needles. And so, okay, is it winter burn? The other thing that could potentially cause yellowing or browning of leaves might be a canker fungus that's infecting a branch and killing that branch and causing the needles to turn yellow. Lots of times with root rots in evergreens, that will lead to needle yellowing or browning as well. So it's like, okay, people send me in some needles that are browned or yellow. I look at those. I don't find anything. I'll ask for a branch sample. I'll ask for a root sample, and we'll try to figure out whether there's a pathogen active somewhere else in the tree or shrub that's causing the problem. And it's a good lesson that when you're seeing something in leaves, that doesn't necessarily mean that the problem is in the leaves. It can be happening somewhere else in the plant. And just the consequence of the pathogen activity is manifesting as a leaf symptom. Mm-hmm. So I like to get photos from folks to look at the whole plant. I oftentimes will recommend it. If you think it's on the leaves, also send me some roots, send me some branches, and we'll look at the health of the entire plant.
Okay. Well, we only got about a minute or so left before we have to go. But is there, you sent me a list of 10. We covered most of them. Is there one that you really wanted to talk about that we didn't cover?
I think chlorosis was on that list as well. And that's one that mm-hmm. we see a lot of, particularly in southern Wisconsin, where our underlying bedrock is limestone. That tends to increase our soil pH. That locks up certain nutrients in the soil like iron and manganese. And with certain really sensitive plants like oaks and azaleas, birch trees, those sorts of things, white pines as well, you tend to get a lot of really yellow foliage on broadleaf plants. What you'll see is lighter colored green or yellow leaves with distinctive dark green veins. And people oftentimes will try to add iron. That won't necessarily work if the soil pH is really high. It can be particularly problematic for trees like red maple, where it's really a manganese deficiency that's the issue. So there's a fact sheet on my website if you want to read more.
Okay. And just basically Google plant diagnosis, a UW plant diagnosis.
Come to my clinic website. We've got tons of fact sheets, lots of information
for you. So much. So thank you so much for being with us again, Brian. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jill, and congratulations again on your first show. This is wonderful.
Thank you so much. Brian is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Stay with us after the news. We are going to talk about evergreen hedges.